brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Lewis, welcome to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on.
No, you're welcome. Thanks for coming on. I've been wanting to speak to you for a while, so I'm glad we could make it happen. Kick us off, I suppose, just by bringing us up to date on the Old Hammer Fiction podcast. How long have you been running the show now?
So I think I'm into my third year now. I started off reading all of the short fiction that was published in anthologies by Games Workshop, by the Games Workshop book imprint, and I read all of the short fiction, and I kind of got to the end of that, and that had been what I thought I was going to do. But when that was coming to an end, I realized I didn't want to stop. So I'm now in the process of recording all of the novels from that that first run of fiction that Games Workshop had between 1989 and 1995. And alongside that, I've kind of branched out occasionally into reading the fiction that appeared in White Dwarves and in things like The Lost and the Damned. My most popular episode is a full reading of the pure background book, While the Orcs, which is people seem to really enjoy. So it's anything that was fiction or kind of, in some cases, setting, but mostly fiction that was written in that initial kind of Brian Ansell era, starting, in the kind of Brian Ansell era and kind of drawing to a close with the release of fourth edition Warhammer Fantasy Battle. Although there's some exceptions around that, because possibly the last two Ian Watson Inquisitor novels were actually published quite a long way into second edition 40K, fourth edition Fantasy Battle. But that's the vision of the podcast, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of inspired you to start doing this in the first place then?
As a kid, I always really liked audiobooks. I had an absolutely sort of awe-inspiring recording of The Hobbit, a reading of The Hobbit by Nicole Williamson, who's the guy that plays Merlin in Excalibur. And I think I've always associated kind of like fantasy stories with audiobooks. So I kind of always wished, even when I was a kid reading these books for the first time, that there were audiobook versions of them. And I had a go at recording it with a cassette as a sort of 10 or 11 year old. It didn't sound very good. But then as someone who then went off and trained to be an actor, even though I'm not an actor now, I kind of realized that was something that I could bring into existence. And I'd got really into podcasts like the Classic Ghost Stories podcast, and something called Pseudopod, which is another horror podcast, where they would do a reading of a piece of short fiction, and then at the end, the host would analyze the thing that they just read. And that's actually kind of become the main inspiration for the show that I do, which is I read now for about sort of 2.5 hours, 3 hours, a piece of fiction. And then at the end of it, I do an analysis of what I think this tells us about the context in which this fiction, this bit of Games Workshop history was created, and what I think the meanings of it. And it's a kind of blend of sort of historical and sort of English literature level kind of analysis. I'd always wanted to do, I thought Oldhammer, there should be a kind of really focused on Oldhammer, an analysis of the Oldhammer era podcast. And my original idea had been to try and tell the story of the development of Games Workshop through reading and analysing the letters pages in White Dwarf. And that had been like the original vision. But it occurred to me that that would take a huge amount of work, kind of like parsing that into a script. And sometimes you got really interesting stuff out of it and sometimes you didn't. Whereas the stories, these works of fiction, always give you a kind of a really clear leaping off point, which you then get to respond to.
Yeah, I mean, your podcast gets a lot of great feedback, as you'll be aware, well aware yourself, obviously. A great deal of that feedback, as much as you do a brilliant job with the stories, a great deal of the feedback that I see is to do with your analysis at the end of the podcast. Just going, like, focused on the story for a second, how do you kind of find that? I mean, you admit yourself in the podcast that some of the stories aren't very good. When you've got, like, a few hours of them to read through, like, how do you approach that? And do you think the podcast could be hamstrung at times when a story just isn't quite hitting the mark?
I suppose I have to do it as well as I possibly can. And I've read some stories I think are absolutely shocking and are like pretty, pretty meritless. But I feel about it is that, you know, you have to give every story a fair crack. You have to give every story kind of like the best run that you can. And then if at the end I'm going to slate it and say why it's nonsense and say why it didn't work, I've then done my very, very best job on it. I'm aware. So, for example, I've read one of the Conrad books and I'm aware that a lot of people think that the second two Conrad books are absolutely rubbish. So I'm kind of stealing myself for that. I'm stealing myself for reading, what's it called? Storm Warriors, the last Brian Craig book. But I guess, like, you've got to try and make it work in that moment. And a lot of it is kind of making up the characters. So you have to kind of go, okay, how am I going to try and make this character compelling? How am I going to try and make this character interesting, even if the things that are happening to them or the wider narrative isn't that great? I mean, what I would say about it, I suppose, is this whole fiction line was a failure. The Games Workshop books line didn't do very well. There were things that came out of it that people really liked. But as a project, it's a failure. So in a way, that's why it's always quite interesting to analyse, because it's you're always analysing stuff that kind of didn't catch fire or didn't quite hit the mark or raise something really interesting but didn't make it. And sometimes, even when something's really shocking and you've had a good listen to it, it's quite interesting to analyse why it misses the mark. And I suppose that kind of compels me to kind of keep on going, so I get the treat of saying what I think is wrong with it at the end. But yeah, sometimes it's a long slog.
Yeah, I mean, I found myself, I'm quite pleased with myself if I think something through a story and you mention it in the analysis. I'm like quite smug about it that I've maybe drawn the same conclusion. So I was chuffed to hear after Plague Demon, you know, after we worked our way through that, and you were basically saying, like, where was the great unclean ones? Like, where was the plague bearers? And all we had was like this good looking woman representing Nurgle, which was just utterly bizarre. So how do you approach the analysis? Like, do you kind of have certain beats you want to hit, certain ways that you break the story down before you pick it apart?
So I read the story without thinking about the analysis. And then as I edit the story and kind of try and cut out all of the mistakes, usually one mistake gets in per episode is my standard. As I edit, I sort of make notes as I listen along back to the story. I suppose I've got kind of two things that I think about quite regularly. Is I often try and think about the, like, placing this story in its historical context. I think one of the things I really found my feet with early on is, like, sort of the idea of all Warhammer stuff as being a post-Chernobyl fiction, and that the idea of the warp gates is a kind of reflection of kind of anxiety about having this nuclear disaster happen somewhere off in the distance, and the effects might be kind of slowly crawling towards you. So I'm always looking to kind of place the fiction in the context in which it's written. I then kind of try and often I'm placing things in the context of what we know about what Games Workshop became. I talk a lot about hauntology and the idea that there are versions of the Warhammer world that could have existed but didn't. So I'm always interested when a writer has kind of made a choice that doesn't chime with, I don't know, what Space Marines went on to become, what Chaos went on to become, but is nevertheless interesting, and what that might say about it. And sometimes I'm just kind of, I'm captured by a sort of a literary comparison or a type of storytelling. So like Plague Demon, hard going, but it got me thinking about Goya's art and what they call Disasters of War, like this kind of series of paintings about the horrors of the Peninsular War and the Napoleonic Wars. And I just kind of got, I went, oh, like there is stuff in that that echoes that. And I'm sure that wasn't Brian Craig's intent, but I'm kind of, some of the time I'm just kind of responding to sort of a thing that reminds me of a thing and then seeing where that takes me.
Do you think the, like the analysis you give to these stories, could you apply that to Games Workshop's history in a wider sense, like beyond the stories, digging into other aspects of the company's past?
I think that it could be, but I think there are people who are way, way, way better at it than I am. You know, you've got Filmdeg out there making those interviews with all of the Games Workshop staff. You've got people like Jordan Sorcery. And I feel like the world of kind of the history of Games Workshop, as in the company and what it did, is really, really well sewn up in terms of having... I think we're at a stage of the Warhammer... the Warhammer historians, aren't we? Let's be frank, people have said it, as the great people who worked for Games Workshop have started to pass away, there has been a real drive for people to want to kind of record that history. And there's people doing a really, really good job on that. I suppose, and I don't really count myself among their number as being like up at the level of people like Jordan or whoever. But I suppose I think what I do alongside that is like literary analysis. I'm more like if Warhammer, the study of Warhammer was a university, I think probably I'm more in the English department than I am in the history department, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. And there's absolutely a lot of strength in having that kind of niche, isn't there? And you're mentioning Jordan Sorcery. It's a podcast that I'm working my way through at the moment, and it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like I literally just did listen to the Mark Gascoigne one yesterday, and he referenced that. You know, we're talking about all the household names, and he says we see each other at funerals a lot, not a lot, yeah, but it's becoming an increasing trend. So yeah, right. It's this historian era now, isn't it?
Yeah, what's interesting about it for me is that, of course, the person that everybody would want to interview the most is Brian Ansell, because he's the kind of the guy who was the driving force behind all of that kind of stuff. And he got interviewed, I think, twice on the Realm of Chaos blog back in the 2000s, but there's no recording of him, there's no kind of big interviews with him. And of course, he's kind of the most important figure. And ironically, what that makes him like is the Emperor in the early Horus Heresy novels, where he's this figure that everybody's talking about and he's really important, but you never meet him. You only have kind of interpretations of what he was like and what he wanted. And some of those sometimes those interpretations don't measure up. And I think that weirdly, having said like it's either history or English literature, that gives the nature of like trying to make Warhammer history this weird literary, almost kind of postmodern thing, because people are always trying to get a handle on what Ansell was trying to do. But we can never ask Ansell, and different people seem to have had like radically different experiences of working with him. So it makes for a very good story as we kind of try to puzzle out that era of the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Obviously, you're doing the podcast, and I've no doubt that, you know, we're working full time in that as well. Like this, you know, you've no shortage of things to be doing. But do you ever think there might be like a book in there somewhere down the line?
I don't know. Like, I don't know what the book would be. I think I make a product that's very good value for free. I think that's kind of probably where I am. I think it's a really good podcast at the price I sell it at, which is nothing. And I don't, you know, obviously I do have people that kind of send me money on Ko-fi, and I'm really grateful for that. But I've been really kind of strict about never going like, this is something that I think has value. Because it's just me noodling away, and sometimes I get it right and sometimes I don't. So I've never really thought about about kind of trying to collate all of these observations together because they're so haphazard. I do sometimes think about whether when I get to the end of the podcast, and there's a point when I will have read every single piece of fiction that fits into my criteria, and it's over 2 years away, but it's not quite 3 years away, whether I will reinvent the podcast into something else. And whether that, you know, sometimes people say to me, like, the best bit is the analysis. And whether if I got into a thing of producing short kind of bits of commentary on bits of Games Workshop lore, whether that would be an effective thing for me to do next.
Mm.
But I suppose one of the things is that I produce one podcast a month, and part of that is I always know what it is I'm doing next. I am going to read this story, then I'm going to review that story. And I think it means you're not working with a blank page. And like, part of me wonders if I got to the point where I was just like, I can write anything I want about anything to do with gaming, Warhammer, then it almost, like, artists thrive on having like a bit of restraint. And I guess there's that kind of thing of going, my job is to try and make Plague Demon seem bearable and then think about what might be interesting about Plague Demon. That's an easier job to do than kind of going, what am I going to do next? Like, what have I got to say? What would I like to talk about? And I think with the podcasts, I don't know if you find this as well, but there's a real thing of, if you have an opportunity to not record an episode, you won't. And it's a kind of discipline of keeping up that kind of one's output that makes a podcast work, because it's so easy for other stuff to get in the way. So, yeah, in answer to your question, I don't know if I have a kind of a coherent vision for a book, but there might be a world where the podcast at some point in the future becomes something else. Or there's another podcast in another format. Not sure. Yeah.
How long do you tend to do your recording sessions? Do you break it up into two or three different sittings?
So I can usually do like 2 to 3 hours in a sitting, kind of having breaks and coming back to it. Often because I'm under the pressure of time. But as I've moved over to the novels, usually I will try and record it at night after everyone's gone to bed over one or two evenings. And like, the episodes are about 3 hours long, usually on average at the moment, when it comes to the recording. And then I kind of have to then the actual recording itself with mistakes can creep up to sort of 3.5 hours. But yeah, usually I get it done in these long stints of kind of getting into the zone. Not least because if I don't have like a dedicated recording space, it's hard to get the audio back, but at exactly the same level. And the thing with doing audio fiction is it's immersive, and you're kind of whispering into someone's ear, and you want them to forget that I'm a real person reading off a book like in my living room, and to sort of transport them away. And I think sometimes those changes in audio quality, or when I shuffle the paper or whatever, that can kind of break that immersion. So I try and do it in these long stints, quite late at night when I've got it's as quiet as it can be.
Yeah, I mean, I've created audio fiction and audio drama for nigh on 15 years now, so I sympathise with a lot of the a lot of the stuff that goes into it, a lot of the work and a lot of the barriers you face as well. I have heard that you know, Black Library, they apparently create audio dramas now, and I've never actually heard one. I'm just curious, like, is the stuff that they put out now, have you ever come across any of it?
So I've only listened to bits and pieces. I've listened to sort of, there are recordings of the Jack Yeovil novels, for example, that they've done. I've listened to, so they did some Horus Heresy specific stuff, a thing called the Lightning Tower that I listened to. And I've heard the guy that does the Horus Heresy reading seems really, really good. I don't know. It's hard for me to judge the Jack Yeovil ones because I've done my own versions of them, and like they've got a female narrator for it, which makes a lot of sense when you've got a predominantly female protagonist. So obviously that's kind of got selling points to it as well. So I think there is loads of good stuff out there, but I don't know whether I'd like compare it to my own work, because I think my work comes from a slightly different place. I'm not the best audio actor out there by quite a long way. I'm not the best voiceover artist out there by a very, very long way, but I'm probably the voiceover, like, I'm not voiceover, the recording artist who knows the most about 1989 to 1995 Games Workshop fiction. And I guess I can kind of bring that to the characterization and to my understanding of the setting. That's probably my selling point compared to Black Library's higher production values and all that type of stuff.
Do you keep up with Games Workshop, like, as a whole these days, like the stuff that they do now?
Not very well. I listen to or watch Arbiter Ian, who is a kind of the lore guy, the lore YouTuber I really like. And he also does a book club where they kind of review the Horus Heresy novels, or they're reading through the Horus Heresy novels. I played Kill Team the other day because somebody invited me to play Kill Team, and I enjoyed it very much. And I keep on thinking I'm gonna get back into it. But behind me right now, I have got an untouched box of the new Epic game and I've got a box from ages ago of Adeptus Titanicus, and I was like, oh, I'm going to get back into this. I'm going to play Legions Imperialis. I'm going to play Adeptus Titanicus, and I never did, because I'm like, I guess my kind of hobby time gets eaten up with either preparing for Bring Out Your Lead, the big old hammer thing, which you can spend a year coming up with ideas for and preparing for, and I play in Turnip 28 tournaments on a sort of twice a year basis. And I'm often kind of getting miniatures ready for that. So that stops me from kind of having the space, having the painting time to get really into modern 40K. All that, and then I kind of vaguely follow the lore. I don't dislike it. It sounds like everything I hear, I think, sounds really, really interesting and really... like some people, I say this quite often, like sometimes I'll post up one of my podcasts and I'll have the art from a 1980s Games Workshop book as the kind of the episode label, or I've kind of put it onto the Facebook pages to kind of attract attention. And people will look at those images and their response is, like, can I swear on your podcast?
Yeah, go for it.
Or not. Yeah. They're like, fuck Modern Games Workshop. Like, this is when it was really good. All the art now is rubbish. And to me, that seems absolutely insane. Like, if I loved the music of Handel, and I was like, man, Handel is like, I'm going to do a Handel podcast, and I'm going to talk about how much I love Handel. If somebody then commented on in response to that, yeah, that's right, fuck Hector Berlioz. Or fuck Stravinsky. You'd be like, well, what on earth are you talking about? Like, in what way is the progress of classical music in conflict with one another? Like, and yet for some reason, people sometimes think Oldhammer is about kind of mourning the loss of this stuff that you liked in comparison to a kind of like faded, ruined version that we're dealing with today. And that's just not how I think about it. If I had an infinite amount of time, I would paint and play modern 40K. Looks really good fun. Looks really, really good fun. But you have to make your choices, don't you? So I'm in no way a modern lore expert. And I think also, probably because I went into a bit of a Games Workshop deep freeze between 1995 up until the 2006, 2007, there's a really big missing chunk in the middle there where lots of stuff happened that I'd never properly be able to fill in. So I think I can never kind of really claim to be kind of cognizant of the development of Games Workshop and the Warhammer settings in that period.
Yeah, that, going back to what you were saying there, that there is, I think, a lot of needless rage out there. Like, if I always wonder, you know, if you're really passionate about the old stuff, you know, old Hammer or whatever genre, whatever era, sorry, that you were into, just focus on that, you know, be positive about that rather than be negative about, you know, what they're doing now if you don't like it. Mm. By the way, shout out to Handel as well. Good to hear him mention his music's very easy to get hold of.
very good indeed.
But it doesn't sound like you're getting much hobby time then these days. Like, do you paint at all? Like, you were talking about preparing for Bring Out the Lead.
Yeah. So at the moment, I have, you know, there's Bring Out Your Lead has like the big Hell's Reach table. So that's not going to happen this year. And I'm working with a team of people who have, we've got half of what would have been the Hell's Reach board. And we're going to do the Siege of Prague as a Mordheim game. So the Siege of Prague is kind of a story that's told in the Lost and the Damned, the Second Realm of Chaos book. And it's sort of the story of like lots of different things happening all over the city of Prague as it's overwhelmed by the forces of chaos. And I'm in the process of building the city of Prague. Or at least we've got 36 square feet of Prague to build, and I'm in the middle of building my 18 square feet of it. So I'm sort of making a lot of chaos corrupted terrain. I've made a giant kind of 6 foot by 6 foot gaming mat that's gonna with like a textured mat. And at some point, I'm going to have to make my own Mordheim gang, that I'm going to actually play on it. But so I'm in the process of doing that. I'm in the process of finishing off 2,000 points of Rogue Trader era orcs, because on the Friday night, I'm going to play a late era Rogue Trader game using the plastic targeting grid. Do you know about that?
No.
So the vehicle rules in Rogue Trader were always a mess. And within a couple of months of Rogue Trader coming out, they were publishing like fixes for the vehicle rules in White Dwarf. And then about White Dwarf 128, 129, there's kind of an article that admits that they've got vehicles really, really wrong. Like a Rhino used to cost hundreds of points and was, you know, like basically just a tin can that drove you up the battlefield. And they completely changed all of the point values, and they completely changed how vehicles worked, where they would give you a kind of side view profile of all of the vehicles that were available at that time. And then if you were shooting at them, you placed a targeting grid over the vehicle, and it was like a perspex sheet with like an X and Y axis and kind of notches marked on it. And then you targeted the vehicle like that, like you were a World War II bomber, and then rolled dice to see where on the targeting grid your shot actually turned up. sounds really, really fiddly, and I haven't tried to use one since I was about 10, but we're going to have a go at using what sometimes gets called the 1.5 era Rogue Trader rule set, which is like Rogue Trader after they started trying to fix the things that were wrong with Rogue Trader, and also sort of after the time when they admitted that actually people wanted to play matched points games of Rogue Trader. Because, you know, like the original thing with Rogue Trader was like, oh, we're going to play a scenario, we'll have a games master, and don't worry about points values. And if you look at White Dwarf from that kind of 88, 89 period, clearly very quickly people were like, no, I want to get together with my mate and fight him on a kind of equal battlefield. So we're going to kind of test out, how do I put it, like matched play Rogue Trader to see whether it worked at all or not. So it's kind of a historical experiment, a bit like being a historical reenactor. So I'm doing that. And then once I've got those two tasks done, I'm booked on the Sunday morning to play Advanced Space Crusade, which is another weird kind of like forgotten game from 1991. So I've got to paint up a load of Marines to go into a Tyranid hive ship and a load of Tyranids to defend it. So I have quite a lot of hobby time and I'm painting all the time, but it tends to be towards these big kind of like objectives. I originally got into Oldhammer because I thought, ooh, I can paint one or two models and I can kind of do it for fun and the joy of painting. And within, you know, a few years of getting into it, it becomes these huge projects which can take a year of planning and kind of and sort of setting targets across months and months and months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like you're keeping busy and bring out your lead. I'll be there as well, so I'll be standing over your shoulder at some point looking at your at your work. My 3-year-old daughter's probably going to be there because my wife's coming down this year. We're tagging on a wee holiday, so I've got the wee one. I've got her, you know, crossbows and catapults. I've got her for her birthday. So I'm thinking of bringing that along because I figured she could bring a game with her as well. So we should need too big a table for that. And I don't think I'll need to do any prep either. So
get them started early.
Exactly.
That was one of my early ones. I think I got that when I was 5. Brilliant.
Yeah. It got re-released, I think, quite recently. I'm looking forward. It was my first Bring Out Your Lead just the summer past and I really enjoyed it. So I'm looking forward to this year as well. Do you go every year?
So this will be my third Bring Out Your Lead. I got to the point where I was really wanting to go just before COVID hit. So I was kind of booked to go in the summer that it got cancelled because of COVID, and then it was cancelled the year after that. So yeah, this will be my third one.
Yeah, and what do you kind of, I mean, you obviously enjoy the event. What do you kind of take out of it the most and get from it?
I think it's got that kind of culture of showcasing. I like the idea of like prepping something and then bringing a game that people can join in on or that you and somebody else have planned together. And it's a kind of a collaborative process. I think that's probably what's really exciting about it. Rather than going and like playing a tournament, you're kind of wandering around participating in a bunch of different things. I think the range of stuff that's happening there, the level of creativity on display is really inspiring. So you've spent all this time working on your thing and then you go there and somebody's created something which is equally inspiring, but in a completely different way. I think the atmosphere is really nice. I think people who are kind of equally inspired by all of this old stuff in a setting that's really, really inspiring. Like you go to the foundry and there are the things from White Dwarf 116, the Gene Stealer cult army and stuff like that. And that's really, really moving for an old hammer person. And I think the time that I that made me realize, oh wow, I really, really like this was the first Hell's Reach game that I participated in. There was Hell's Reach begins. You have a Necromunda gang and you are sort of at a place on the table, and everybody, when Curtis says go, moves their models at the same time, and then everybody fires at the same time, and then everybody fights at the same time, and then you kind of, once everybody's moved, done that, you go back and start the round again. And what really inspired me about, like, that sounds like it's going to be absolute chaos, and it is chaotic, but what really interested me about it is the kind of narratives that emerged on that table. And with no pre-planning, no kind of pre-imagination, you started like, oh, like you and me, we should work together. Let's go and attack that gate. And a story emerged from nothing. And that was, and that's kind of something I've never experienced in miniature wargaming before, where you're kind of actually kind of creating narratives out of nowhere. And I think that like the people get really like het up about narrative rather than competitive gaming. And I'm not like that. I've really enjoyed competitive gaming in my time as well. But I think there is something in like an environment that really revels in the storytelling. And I think you can really see that around the battlefields when you're at Bring Out the Lead, your lead. You could see it when there was a massive siege game last year, and like really, really huge fantasy battle siege game. And it's a stupid idea. It's like really, really kind of hard to pull off. There were millions and millions of people. You'd walk away from the table and then come back, and it would seem like nothing had happened. But it looked beautiful. And I think it was compelling because it was like a game full of these little vignettes of storytelling. So I suppose I think that's what makes Bring Out Your Lead exciting, is there's lots of narrative. It's a day where you see lots of games that revel in the story that games can tell using miniatures that you remember, or evoking miniatures that you remember from your childhood. And in my case, I think it was the stories that came out of White Dwarf, the games books, that really, really inspired me. So it's a narratively inspiring experience. And that's before you get to like how beautiful and how creative people are with their modelling and with their miniatures as well, because they are incredibly so.
Yeah, I listened to a podcast, Trapped Under Plastic. It's very American focused, but recently they obviously had Adepticon out there, and they described that as the Super Bowl of Warhammer. You know, bring out your leg is a different thing. Bring out your lead is definitely the Super Bowl of Old Hammer, and I think mm-hmm. it's just it takes Old Hammer to the extremes. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's shown, you know, it's pushing the boundaries of what is possible, a real showcase. And yeah, I agree with everything you've said about it. It's just that.
And I think what I love about it as well is it's not about putting only old models on the table. And I think Garth has got like Garth's kind of vision for that is like, it's about, oh, like this old game and these games, but that doesn't mean anything about the rule set. Doesn't mean anything about the models you use, except for the fact that they should be painted. And I think that's, you know, that's a really inspiring choice on his behalf. And that's probably why it's so inventive, because it's so loose for people to interpret as they see fit.
Our question of the month for May 2025 is quite simply, what are your favourite games? The rule sets you'll always find yourself coming back to again and again. Maybe you have one miniatures game to rule them all, and you only ever play that. Or perhaps you have a stable of games that cover each genre, from naval and space warfare, to dungeon bashing, to 6mm sci-fi and beyond. Tell us about the games you love by going to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail, and I need them in by Friday the 30th of May. That's bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail, and now back to the show. One of the kind of last wee things that I wanted to dig into, I'm obviously respectful of your time, but I just wanted to ask you a wee bit about your hobby origins. You know, back in the day mm-hmm. when you kind of discovered this hobby and your kind of tentative early steps into it.
So I think I probably started really, really early. I was a fighting fantasy kid. My older cousin gave me some fighting fantasy books. And I remember instantly being taken in by that. But I think more by the setting than I was by playing and dying, playing these fighting fantasy books. So I loved, when I was like 8 or 9, I loved Titan. I loved Out of the Pit, those kind of fighting fantasy background books that explain the setting. And then from there, at some point, I got a White Dwarf. My first White Dwarf was 117. I think it's September 1989. So I'd have been 9 going on 10. And I realized that there were this whole other world that I could get into. And I really, really, as quite a young kid, flung myself into that. And then from there, I did I think when I went to secondary school, there was a war games club at school and we played a lot of Epic. We must have been playing the end of Rogue Trader into second edition, and then the end of third edition into fourth edition. And we got really into that. I played quite a lot of Warhammer Fantasy roleplay as a young kid. But I think actually my kind of hobby origin happened at a really, really young age. So I got madly into Warhammer as a sort of 10-year-old, was really, really obsessed with it. But I guess 10-year-olds can't go to gaming clubs and 10-year-olds can't hoof around with their miniatures. So my hobby origin is always more as a kind of imaginative thing that I then got to do a little bit as an actual game when I got to secondary school. But I quickly moved on from that to World of Darkness. I think there was a moment when I was oh, actually I'm into role playing and also probably I was interested in being cool and appealing to girls. And I remember having the poster for Man of War, that could come with a White Dwarf on the wall of my bedroom. And I can remember looking at that and thinking, you can't really have a big picture of an orc fighting a dwarf on a boat and kind of try and come across like you're a sexy guy at the same time, you know? I don't know if I articulated it quite like that in my mind, but it was kind of, I hit a thing of kind of going these things don't go well together, do they? So I think I also probably had an early hobby origin and then quite an early hobby exit as well, as I shifted from that to being sort of reading and being interested in what I thought was these more mature Vampire the Masquerade books. And then I went into what the Grognard files call the deep freeze, which is sort of when you kind of fall out of it. But I guess I came back to Games Workshop in 2006, 2007. No, it must have been before that, actually. I started buying, when they were selling off all the old lead models, I went and bought a load of Necromunda models when they were selling them off really cheap in all the Games Workshops. And from there, I then bought the Warhammer rulebook again, built an undead army, built a Space Marine army out of the starter kit and stuff like that from one of the starter boxes, and slowly got back into it. Although I wasn't playing, I was just painting these models, and then got back into it fully when I kind of settled down and was going out with my now wife and was kind of interested in kind of doing something in the evenings. Now we didn't go out anymore. So it was that's kind of the journey, a really early exposure as a 10-year-old, and then kind of 10 to 14, and then a hard break for another 13 years, I guess.
What does your wife make of your Man of War poster?
It's long gone, actually. In my office that I'm recording this in, I have got some John Blanche art. And I've got some original Vampire the Masquerade art, and she's very understanding about that. I don't know what she'd think now if I had the full on, because the Man of War poster was big as well, wasn't it? It's like A1. It was one of those fold out A1 posters, and I don't know what she'd think of that. I still try and kind of because people have to when you have guests, they have to sleep in this room, and I try not to have like too much stuff of like a guy hitting another guy with an axe, if I can manage it.
Harry the Hammer.
But no, but yeah, exactly. Yeah, like although yeah, I suppose like that like with or any John Blanchard, it does look like art at the same time as being a Warhammer image as well. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think like it feels like it draws its inspirations from somewhere else as well. But whereas if I suppose I had the art from here, from like Warhammer Quest on the wall, and those really kind of like bright and punchy heroic picture of a dwarf or something, I couldn't try and pass it off as kind of like an artist's artwork in quite the same way, good though it may be.
Yeah. It's been a really good chat, Lewis. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry. I'm aware that I've just done verbal diary. I'm used to being on my own, you see, and just recording by myself. So I'm afraid I've done these big long chunks rather than backing and forthing with you.
No, it's ideal for me. I'm doing my Radio 4 now, really close to the mic and quiet, because the wee one's sleeping next door anyway. So it suits me down to the ground. I've enjoyed your answers. Just fill us in on, you know, what's coming next for the podcast, what you're working on at the moment. And
so at the minute, I'm working on, my battery's running low, but I'm working on a Dark Future story. I would like, and I'd appeal to people to give Dark Future a try. It's really, really, it's like a lot of Jack Yeovil fiction. It's some of the highest quality fiction that was produced in this period. And I'm halfway through, or a third of the way through, recording the first of the novels. The short story that's a prequel to the novels is already recorded. And I'm doing these Dark Future stories, the premise being it's set in the world of the Dark Future game, which is cars chasing one another in the desert in a Mad Max style. But what it really is a sort of alternate history version of America with Cthulhu elements to it. And it's and you find out in the first short fiction that Jack Yeovil, Kim Newman did, that there was a single event that occurred in the 1960s that meant that the America of the Dark Future world, the world of the Dark Future world, has ended up being very different from our own. And it's produced all sorts of kind of alternate outcomes. Things like Geoffrey Archer is now the Prime Minister of Great Britain. And you've ended up with Charlton Heston as President of America at some point in the past and things like that. And also rock and roll music emerges from Russia rather than from America. So I'm really enjoying those, but they don't have quite the same like immediate brand recognition and mass market appeal of doing a story about space marines. Mm-hmm. It's been really good fun.
Cool.
I'm working on my American accents as well. Trying all the time.
So for any of the listeners, if there are indeed any that haven't heard of the Old Hammer Fiction podcast before, how might they get it? Anywhere they could go to check it out?
Yeah, I'm on Spotify. I'm on most podcast providers that you can find. I'd encourage you to sort of miss the first two episodes maybe and like pick a story you recognise and start later on when I got my recording skills sorted out. But that would be my recommendation. You can find me anywhere. You can also find me on Instagram and Blue Sky. It's the Old Hammer Fiction Podcast. And I'm on all the Old Hammer Facebook groups for the most part.
Lovely stuff. I'll put a link, obviously, in the show notes to the podcast too.
Ideal.
And yeah, like I say, Lewis, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. And it's been great to talk to you.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for having me. You're a hero.
Thank you. Never been called that before, but I'll take it.
Oh, there you are. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.